Hey everyone, welcome to Office Hours with Cloud Posse, your weekly dose of insider DevOps trends, AWS news, and Terraform insights, all sourced from our Sweet Ops community, plus a live Q&A you can't find anywhere else. It's February 26th, 2025. I'm your host, Eric Osterman. Real quick, I'm the founder and CEO of Cloud Posse. We're a DevOps accelerator for AWS infrastructure that helps teams deploy their software faster. And we do this by leveraging our ecosystem of over 200 Terraform modules that have been battle tested and downloaded over 100 million times. So if you or your team has been banging your head against the wall with Terraform, just head over to cloudposse.com/meet, answer a few quick questions, and I'll show you how you can manage infrastructure in a better way. So how can you maximize today's session? Our format is very informal. You can engage as much as you'd like, ask questions, and if you're curious about any of our open source tools or modules, you can go for it. This is a great place to ask. And for those on the recording, we host these calls live. Join us by going to cloudposse.com/officehours. Now, I do have one ask. If you find any portion of today's session valuable, share it with your team. Just head over to youtube.com/cloudposse, where you'll find the recording posted in a few hours. So with that said, let's jump into things. Let's see what I got for this week. All right. First one. Yeah, if you're in our Sweet Ops Slack community, you'll have probably gotten kicked out of a few channels. We archived a bunch of channels that just saw less activity, so we can try and focus more of the conversation in a smaller set of channels. I think that's just the natural thing that happens. Even at Cloud Posse in our private Slack, there's a lot of channels that once made a lot of sense and don't make so much sense anymore. So yeah, do check that out. Next announcement was something that I just got an email on this morning. I thought it was interesting. Let's Encrypt is actually ending support for the email notifications. And I get it. It's interesting. When Let's Encrypt came out, it was really just about enabling anyone who needed a TLS certificate to get one. But let's face it, with 90-day expirations, the only way you can practically use those certificates is not manually renewing them. So the automations like Cert Manager and the various extensions to some of the other ingress controllers and Nginx natively supports it. You don't really need these email notifications anymore. That said, the email notifications do serve as a poor man's monitoring system if your certificate rotations aren't happening. So I'm sure some people are going to get bit in the butt pretty hard when these notifications stop going out. But the justification is, as you would expect, it's costing them tens of thousands of dollars a year to manage the infrastructure sending out all those email notifications. And a lot of people aren't even probably checking those out. The other justification is that it is a very privacy-oriented service. So having all those email addresses on file kind of goes against the privacy aspect there. So that's that. Anyone have thoughts on this one?
Can we get more companies to agree to stop sending us email? That would be great.
Exactly. I don't think there's going to be a big what's the word? Revolt against less email here or email notifications.
Yeah, this wouldn't be at the top of my list of where I would start to not get emails, but I get it.
Yeah, they've gotten out of control.
Yeah, they mentioned RedSift for monitoring. Is anybody here using RedSift to monitor their certs?
No. Get the service. I have some old I just have a Slack bot somewhere that tells me when a cert is expiring. Get 100 domains for free or something. So some slack gap. All right. Next announcement. This one's interesting. Microsoft pulled a very popular theme for VS Code from the marketplace. And it was reported to them by security researchers that the theme had some malicious intent indicated through the code itself. I haven't yet seen the official announcement if it's come out, but the top post here is the official, air quote, official response from GitHub or somebody on the GitHub security team about what happened. Anyone have more insight on this, or was anyone affected by it?
Although it looks like the original post that talked about it has been taken down.
Yeah, I'm not sure why that is. I looked at it. This was like the post from the person who reported it on the Web Archive.
Yeah, maybe it was not following like the right ethical reporting guidelines or something.
Right, responsible disclosure.
Yeah.
Yeah. But what was interesting to me, and I didn't know that this was possible, on the one hand, I think it's probably for the better, but it also does raise concerns. So they were able to revoke this from the marketplace and uninstall it everywhere that it was installed. So yeah, I didn't know Microsoft had that ability.
Bleeping Computer just posted about it about 28 minutes ago. And it says Microsoft removed both extensions from the VS Code marketplace and banned the developer. That's crazy.
Yeah, so it seems to be mostly just borrowing what came from this top post. Well, next announcement.
Now,
Well, okay, go
it
ahead.
makes me. Oh, sorry. I was gonna say now it makes me. I'm gonna go look at the VS Code source code to see how they actually revoke, like re uninstalled it everywhere, because that seems weird. Like, because usually you can only install an extension if you like, if you actively like click install on something. Like, how do they trigger an action to occur without you taking an action in VS Code? That's what my that piqued my curiosity, so I'm gonna have to go look at the source code for that.
And what problems does that create? And can extensions have uninstall steps or uninstall scripts that run? And so that if this is exploited, can you therefore also force en masse something like this to actually take a malicious action? So.
It says that there's a release notes JavaScript file that in the theme that contains heavily obfuscated JavaScript. And part of the deobfuscation of the code shows it references usernames and passwords, but it's so heavily obfuscated that they can't tell what the code's doing.
Yeah, I mean, anyone who's tried to read minified code, good luck to you. Like, and then if you, that's just without even trying to take steps to obfuscate, like, what's going on. Like, so if you're purposely doing it, I guess that makes a lot of sense. Although you'd think some static analysis tools could pick up on things like that.
Or AI being pretty good at unraveling.
I'm just saying, like, before they allow an extension to be published in the marketplace,
I see.
they should be able to run static analysis on it to be like, it doesn't reference any environment variables. It doesn't try to read Etsy password. It doesn't try to do blah, 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 blah. Like, there should be a list of things that, are no-brainers for them to check that that the extension isn't doing.
In other news, continuing on Amazon's housekeeping that's been going on for the past 6 months or so, they are sh sunsetting Chime. Chime came out, my guess is during the COVID era, COVID time, when everyone was jumping online or moving from work at home, and Zoom stock shot up. Chime was a very bad copycat of Zoom, and like Zoom from years ago. They recently did a huge facelift on it, think towards the end of last year. It looked a little nicer, but no threaded conversations. You couldn't edit messages. It was really bad.
So maybe I'm misunderstanding something. I've never heard of this before, but read the
Okay.
very last line that's on your script on your screen about what they recommend you move to. The heck
Okay, I
is
thought.
AWS Wicker?
Oh, Wicker, yeah. And the other service nobody's heard about. So I know Wicker because I was friends with some of the people or acquaintances with some of the people at that company before they were acquired. But yeah, it's a security first, like Telegram-like service that Amazon offers. But again, I haven't used it, but based on Amazon's track record with Workdocs and Chime and these productivity tools in general that Amazon does, they are, yeah, I don't know. They're missing something.
Yeah, although I guess the next line then says that they're going to make Zoom their official meeting app, like internally going forward, I
Yeah.
guess.
And I think the writing on the wall was on the wall here because a few months ago, one of our customers, well, Amazon recommended themselves to set up a shared Slack channel with one of our customers. So now in hindsight, we could see why that was happening. The only reason I really know Chime is as an AWS partner, this was the inside track to how to get a hold of anyone at Amazon. If you know their email address, you could basically chat with them via Amazon Chime. But I really disliked it as a solution. So no tears for
Some
me.
Zoom rep just made his quarter.
Yeah, I also heard that they're going to go with Teams as well. They're going to have support Teams.
Oh, interesting. For some of their corp, that's interesting. Yeah, this customer I'm thinking of, we're not happy that they had to use Slack either. So that makes sense then.
Yeah.
I loved it because it forced them into Slack. We just now, yeah, we're getting to the point where I guess we have to support both. All right, so that's that news. This was something I can't believe if I we reported on it before at on office hours. So there's YQ, JQ, JQ being the original, TQ now being one of these for Terraform or HCL. Clearly a pretty simple implementation under the hood because HCL is reducible to JSON and there's HashiCorp libraries for doing that. So I'm guessing under the hood, this is using Go JQ, which is a re-implementation of JQ and Go and just doing that for HCL.
It read that right there where it says note under install. It actually shells out to
Oh,
JQ, the
shells.
binary.
Ah! Oh, interesting. Okay. Bad guess. Not the way I would have thought they do it. Next announcement. Yeah, Zach shared his post a few weeks ago, I think, on how he demonstrated that you can use the relatively new encrypted state offered by OpenTofu to commit your state files to VCS. Obviously, opening up other questions about how that would actually work at scale with any sort of team environment and the merge conflicts would be a nightmare. All that aside, I think the assertion was it was okay for personal projects. Somebody else has implemented a wrapper for Terraform. That just means a tool that calls Terraform after first performing some operations. So I don't think I would take this seriously as an approach, but somebody obviously spent a lot of time thinking about it and looked and found some workaround that works for them. This brings up an interesting point, though. In the Terraform core, and this is something Matt's brought up, it's pretty sad that they haven't made backends pluggable because that would open up a lot of opportunities. And the reason a wrapper like this is required is that you cannot Like in the provider model, you can't create a provider for a backend, and they don't have a similar plugin model for backends as they do providers.
It's almost like they're preventing people from competing with a product that they have that is a backend as a service.
Ah, that's probably right. Yes. So that would be an interesting one. If I wonder if that would be enough of a diff one, there isn't a differentiator that OpenTofu needs, but maybe, a pluggable backend architecture would be one additional move in that direction.
Yeah, the problem is that they'd have to fork the provider SDK in order to do that, and then that gets into a whole messy thing because now you're for sure breaking Terraform compatibility for doing that, you know.
That's a major thing. All right. Next announcement was a few things that caught my eye. These were trending on Reddit. Was some changes coming to Docker Hub. So good news is if you pay for pro, team, or business subscriptions, you will have unlimited pulls with a fair use, asterisk there. So that might improve some things from a CI perspective. But worst news is unauthenticated pulls are getting reduced to 10 per hour. So this is really aggressively rate limiting it, basically saying pony up or move elsewhere.
Well, that's unauthenticated users. You can still authenticate with a free account and get 100
Oh, and get
pulls an
100.
hour. But the question is that images or is that layers? What counts as a pull?
I forget what the technical term is. Well, I mean, I forget what the technical measurement is.
Because if
When
it's
I first
layers, you
talked
might
about it, it
not.
was the manifest.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah. So you could pull the manifest 10 times an hour, but then you could pull the layers more than that. It was a separate rate limit. That's going to be fun for EKS and Kubernetes clusters.
But if they haven't been encountering that yet.
That's why you all the images that you rely on, you should just in your startup script for the node, you should just pull them once so they're in your Docker cache.
Or many alternative solutions.
That's
Well,
the
this means you
cheap
have more than 10 to
way to go.
pull. That doesn't help for scale up though.
Well,
Definitely.
assuming you're not scaling up more than, 100 nodes an hour or whatever, then you should be, or whatever, divided by the number of images you rely on, then you might be able to get around it this way. Or the better thing is use like ECR as a pull-through cache, and then you don't have to worry about it.
The other thing we've been doing using public.aws dot or ecr.aws, which has a mirror of a lot of the mainstream images.
That's still by IP address too, isn't it? So if you've got like a NAT gateway or something, then you're just going to get hammered on the rate limiting.
Yeah, that too. Exasperated by that. For sure.
It's been a wee while now, but I'm curious if GitHub Action Runners still have that rate limiting. I remember a few actions use a Docker image they pull as part of the
They
action.
definitely
And
do.
you, yeah, and it very quickly you run into rate limiting, like 10 runs or fewer, you run into it.
We run into that. So yeah, it's definitely a thing if you don't put in a workaround for it. Some of those actions support specifying a different location for the Docker image, which is one workaround or some kind of a pull-through cache configuration. But the other sad thing with Amazon's solution is their pull-through cache doesn't support private not private registries and also not all public registries. It's only like select registries, I believe.
And I'm almost certain the pull-through cache, even that has some sort of like ingress egress cost, especially if it's across accounts.
Yeah, it will. But we're talking rate limit problems now, less, cost optimization.
Fair, fair.
To be clear, though, the pull-through cache definitely does support Docker. So you could the
Docker
Docker
Hub,
red
yes.
the Docker registry. So you can use it for anything that's in that.
Cool. And yeah, that's the end of my announcements. Let's see, anything in the chat here? Cube fledged. Oops, this opened up in window. A Kubernetes operator for creating and managing a cache of container images directly on the cluster worker nodes. So application pods start almost immediately.
This is like a product to do what I just said.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But can it?
It's an operator, which is
Yeah, but
cool.
can
So
other pods then share from that cache, or is it only a cache on per node, so to say?
the actual Docker, like the Docker engine is running on the node, right? So the cache for that engine gets populated like on that actual node. Like, so if you have you rely on Nginx,
Yeah.
like the operator makes it so that all of your nodes have Nginx cached, so that even when a new pod starts up, it just pulls it from the local cache. It doesn't need to actually download it
Yeah.
from
So
Docker.
basically, it's just warming your local Docker node cache,
Yeah.
your local Kubernetes node Docker cache.
Correct.
Makes
Which
sense.
is what I was saying. I've done it before as a like a cloud init script basically on the node. So when a new node comes up, it does the same thing.
Might as well fail fast, right?
Yeah.
Joking.
Of
Hit those
course.
rate limits as fast as possible.
Yeah, one of the places I used to work at, we used Zarf because we had air-gapped clusters, and then it actually had a shared storage across all the different worker nodes so that it would cache once and then distribute it.
Oh, that's
Yeah.
really interesting. I didn't know that about that. Know that you worked with Zarf, Jonathan. How did you end up using Zarf?
Hospital IT, we had to deploy clusters into their network.
Interesting. Gosh, I feel bad now. I forget his name. One of the early engineers there was an office hours participant for many years, going back to the first episodes of Office Hours. Oh,
Small world.
yeah. So Zarf has the ability to have a private Docker cache, basically, that everything can pull from.
Yeah, it's got a built-in registry and then it can replicate the storage.
That's cool. Is that
I guess in oh, sorry,
included
go
with
ahead.
the open source version of it, or?
Yeah.
Cool.
I was going to say, I think you could probably replicate the storage part if you were to use like an EFS volume or something as your Docker cache. You could point to that. I don't know performance wise what that would be like, but in theory, you could do that across all of your nodes. And then whichever the first node is to download it, every other node would have access at that point.
Yeah, and it can do anything OCI, so it can even do your Helm charts and stuff too.
Very cool. All right. Anything else?
I had one thing to mention that they just released I think officially they released it yesterday. Some people got early access, so I've had access for a couple of days to Claude 3.7. They upgraded from 3.5 to 3.6 to 3.7 now, and it is a significant improvement. And they have both a thinking model and a like worker model. And the thinker model takes much more time to run, but it is actually significantly improved in its reasoning abilities and doing a lot of that thing. And then the benchmark that ChatGPT, not ChatGPT, but OpenAI released, they ran the new Claude engine against it, and it's basically like a 14% improvement over Claude 3.5 in solving complex coding problems and a bunch of other things. So And it's much better than a bunch of other models out there. So in my couple of days experience on it, it has been way better at solving problems than previous models, but that's obviously anecdotal. But it feels just much better and much faster.
And you're using that with cursor predominantly, or?
Yeah. So, but they also at the same time, it's kind of interesting. They released I forget what it's called, but it's the CLI tool is just called Claude. It's like Claude something. I forget what it
Claude
has.
Code, I think it was. Claude
Yeah,
Code.
Claude Code.
I saw
Yeah.
that. Yeah,
And
what's that about?
it's basically like Cursor, but in a CLI. So you run it again, you change into your directory and you run against it, and you can ask it to do different things, and it base in your terminal, it will give you like interactive agent mode, and it will go through and change things, update things, follow it, do everything that you would expect it to do. I just I in kicking the tires, it doesn't seem nearly as good as Claude. I'll stick to Claude. I mean, not to Claude, to Cursor.
It
But
makes me think of
sorry.
Mods by Charm Bracelet, which was like a AI CLI that you can pipe things into and do things with, but
Yeah, this more you just run in a directory, and it's like running, like you would with any AI that's built into the IDE at that point. You can ask it questions about the code that's in that directory, ask it to refactor it, ask it to do, whatever, and it will act on that local directory. Honestly, I think they've done a really good job, like from a 2E perspective. Like I think there's a lot of really good like animations and feedback, and it's clean the way they do it, but it just doesn't feel nearly as good as working inside the IDE to me. But
is there a demo video or anything?
I don't know. I just installed it and ran it. It wasn't very hard to do.
For what it's worth, I've been using Goose a lot more. I link that in the chat. I like it because you can pretty quickly add MCPs to it.
What's MCP?
Model Context Protocol lets you,
Oh.
it's kind of a, you can think of it as an alternative to RAG maybe, but not really. It's sort of a cross-cutting concern where you can instead expose tool parameters to the model. It depends on the models, though. Not every model will work with it. You have to make sure that it accepts tool parameters, but Claude does, for instance. And
Yeah.
then you would go to a website like I think it's I forget what the website is. There's a collection of these MCPs, smithery.ai, I think. Yeah.
There's a whole bunch of ones now, but it's basically a protocol that they've come. So if you think about it as like RPC for AI models, that's essentially what it is. It's like they've defined this so that you can hook up all these different data sources to your model through the use of using MCPs, and you can do two-way control. So you can query other things for information, or query or send commands to other things across the MCP boundary to ask it to do work on your behalf. It's kind of like that.
Somebody created a bridge with the Terraform provider interface.
Well, I
That one
did
I
goof
haven't
off with
seen.
Gatmos, just for the fun of it. You can, for instance, make a really basic one that runs Atmos validate stacks, and then ask it to do some changes to your stack catalog, and it'll actually check. And if it's wrong, it reads the error message and doesn't stop working until it fixes all the validation errors, which is kind of fun.
That's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, I've seen a few where they're the a lot of the tools I'm seeing people integrate now are like Linear and Jira, so that they can like update bug statuses, or like read the description from this feature and help me implement it,
Yeah.
that kind of thing. And then I've seen a lot of people who have hooked up like Sentry and Honeycomb and other bug tools. So you can say like query the latest list of bugs and and begin to try to fix them, you know, that kind of thing, and
Yeah,
then see what it will
I've
do.
been
So.
doing that with yeah, exactly. That's why I was asking earlier, Eric, about the linear API key. I hook that up and you give it git access and you can just say, hey, can you read all the PRs that have been merged in the main branch and update my linear tasks and that sort of stuff.
I think what's cool though is also you're seeing like Stripe and other more like business analytic services starting to create MCPs. And so I think it's starting at like a developer centric level, but I think it's also migrating into the business side. And so I'm really curious to see like what do integrations look like with kind of business centric users? And how do applications change at the protocol level?
Yeah.
What does the SOAP envelope look like for all this stuff? Sorry.
Oh, that
They
is pain. I can't believe you
tried all
said
this
that.
in the they tried all this in the 90s.
Oh, when you said the SOAP, my mind went there, but I couldn't think that you were actually talking about the SOAP protocol.
Oh gosh. I'm just thinking of XML pain right now and it's terrible. But don't worry, I'll get some Tylenol. I would say, one thing about this though, in my experiments, if you use Goose, it lets you very easily swap the different models of an OpenRouter and check them all out. And there's several that claim that they use tools. And I just want you to be wary that even say like for instance DeepSeek does support tool parameters, but if you try to use them, they're nowhere near as proficient as Claude. And some of OpenAI's I think like O3 will try to use them, but ends up usually forgetting them. And so there's a few different AI models you'll want to use. I think Qwen is pretty good. Claude is great, and I think the O4 is also pretty good. And Goose actually gives you like a web page as a benchmark for it. They kind of tell you the different models that are currently performing really well with tool parameters. But just that's my disclaimer for it. If you go to DeepSeek, there's a non-zero chance that if it gets frustrated with your Git tool, that it might just decide to delete the directory, you know?
The fix here is just to delete the code.
We'll just reclone this from the remote. Oh wait, I had changes locally. Oh well, those are gone now.
I'll give another plug since we're talking about the same kind of stuff here. If I don't know if anyone follows or watches a pretty popular YouTube personality, a guy named Theo Brown. He used to work at Twitch and he's founded a couple of other things and he's famous for having a lot of like hot takes and controversial opinions on it and everything else. But he built a new product called T3 Chat. So it's like T3.chat and it's essentially tackling all the bad UX experiences that people have had on like the websites of all these popular tools, and they've spent a lot like in the way that Mitchell Hashimoto spent time like tweaking every pixel on his new terminal. They're kind of doing the same thing about like rendering and glitches and timeouts and all that kind of thing with this. And if you go down the bottom there where it says Gemini 2 Flash and pop that up, you can see they support a ton of different models that you can enable in your chat and interact with and all
Can
that.
you
So
import your chat history?
from like another chat agent,
Yeah, like from ChatGPT, for example.
I don't know about that, but he's prolific on Twitter. Hit him up and ask him, and I'm sure he'll answer you. He's very much about like reaching out to founders of products that he uses and asking them questions. So I'm sure he would welcome that question if you asked them. So,
It kind of reminds me of Find, Phind, if you've ever used that.
No, I don't know them.
And to tie it back to a full circle, I think Theo was one of the most notable guys to clone that material theme because he loves his little controversies. So
Oh,
he
yeah,
cloned
he
the
was.
material theme, changed the license, and said, "I promise not to sue you version." for what it's worth, I just checked out his README. It's been updated just a few hours ago. It turns out he has audited the repo. VS Code team has audited his repo since it's a fork, so naturally you're going to be a little bit cautious of it.
Interesting. He definitely is, for lack of a better word, he's a good shit stirrer.
The thing that I was going to mention about Find is it's a neat interface. If you ask a simple question, it has a lot more options for reworking parts of the solution. So it kind of edits its context, I think, really well compared to others where it's just continually growing context and slower responses. So it's kind of it's a neat approach.
Well, I think I need to up my game here. Falling behind in the model game.
It really feels that way, eh? Just every morning you wake up and there's one more new thing to learn about.
I definitely take the TikTok approach where it's one day, the ticking process is adding, and then your talk time is to spend time getting good at the tools you've learned and to really assess what is working and what isn't before exploring. So I tend to go a week, I try to learn new stuff. Another week, I'm like, okay, no more learning stuff. Try to just be productive with what I got. And that's been my advice to people about the AI marketplace.
Yeah, I think the one thing that I'm always amazed at that people don't seem to be paying enough attention to is if you look at all the models and look at their and look at their price per like million tokens in and million tokens out, and they are just wildly different. Like some models are just so expensive, you don't realize like how limited you want to use them. Like they release these new models and you see them like sitting in all these tools and you start using them and like you ask it three questions and then all of a sudden it's like you're out of tokens for the day and you didn't realize that's because you just asked a question that cost $15 or whatever it is to answer it in their model. So
And
some
some
of
of the
it's not
tools do
surprising.
that. Like Ader uses the least tokens I've ever seen of an AI chat helper, much less than even Cursor. And then Goose is about in the middle. And then other tools, I feel like the one problem with Klein, it uses tons of tokens.
Here's the thing I've been using. If you open that link, it will show you all the different models and the costs
Oh, interesting.
in and out per million input and per million output tokens. I mean, some of them are like, if you click like the sort by that, I mean, you can see some crazy, even if you drop down to like AI provider and go to like just Anthropic models, just in and of themselves, you could see they range from like, from whatever, under $1 per million tokens to over, 8 or over 15, I guess 15 for Claude 3 Opus. So yeah, I mean, it's pretty crazy. And then some of the I guess they don't have all the providers here, but some of the others are like significantly more expensive, and you don't realize how expensive they are to use.
So, for example, with Opus, why is it valued so much more?
More memory.
Because of the compute power it takes to actually run it. Like they're basically passing on the they're passing on like their cost plus whatever their desired markup is to, to end user. So like these models that become more efficient at doing things, it's actually, bringing down the cost. That's why when a lot of these costs were significantly higher until DeepSeek released their model, like, a couple weeks ago or whatever. And then a whole bunch of people had to end up cutting their prices because
Really?
they weren't anywhere close to being like competitive. So yeah.
Interesting.
I don't know.
Interesting.
Personally, I still think the Claude Sonnet models are the best, even though they're kind of on the pricier side. For coding.
Interesting. Yeah.
I've been leaning more and more on Quinn when I can, though. It's cheap and it does a lot of the basic stuff pretty well.
And are you using that through a cloud provider, or are you running that locally on like Ollama or something like that?
I'm using OpenRouter for that.
Okay.
Remarkable
Could you
how
remind
large
me, is
the
it
context is.
Cursor or is it a different code editor which features that little button where you can pay $3 and it will do like a deep dive of finding bugs for you, or at least tries to find bugs? And more often than not, it actually is pretty useful, but I can't figure out which code editor it was.
Well, Cursor does have a bug finder, right? Right, Matt?
Yeah, although Cursor just released their latest version, which has a lot of improvements, and now they just have a unified chat. So you can ask it to find bugs. You put it in agent mode and then ask it to find bugs, and it will find bugs and fix them for you. Like, it no longer has like a different tab specifically for
Wow, look at this screenshot. This is
that.
obviously from last year about this bug finder feature. I think Rishav is talking about,
That's the one. That's the one.
and it does give a preview here of what that run was going, that click is going to cost you.
Wild. I know you
Thank
can
God
justify
they have that,
it.
if something's that expensive.
Well, and that was probably Claude. I bet if you were to change it to something like even just I think there's like the Llama 70B version of DeepSeek that would go down by 2 decimal points.
Yeah, although to be fair, like the context windows on even the biggest models aren't more than, a couple, like, 4K or whatever is probably one of the biggest ones that I've seen. I mean, not 4K, 4
Is different.
megs. I meant to say 4
Okay.
megs
I was gonna
is
say 4K.
no, 4 megs is what I meant to say. And then, like, if you think about how much code you have in like a lot of these applications, just setting the context up to the model to ask the model the question is like a ton of tokens just right off the bat. I think that's what like is hard, because it to find a bug, it basically has to read like all of the code in your entire like app and then try to make, reasoned
Yeah.
decisions on that. So
I think the reason why Aider is so low on token usage, even with large repos, I notice what it'll do instead is it'll run grep or other things. It'll use MCP calls to just say, give me the snippets of code, and it'll search lightly through your code base, get all of the different token details, and that's much quicker and smaller than reading whole files. So I've been watching it just to see if any other tools do that. Not a
of
lot
course, if
do.
you do like a far more complex queries, it's going to explode your token size from the reasoning models and whatnot, that it'll
For
ask
sure.
multiple questions. And of course, I ask these questions that I'll never answer right, and then it would cost me way too much to actually run these. So yeah, so try to confuse them, but
Yeah, that's very fair, though.
any other questions we can get answered today? Totally open-ended. Any gripes?
Don't ask that.
Wait, did anybody already discuss the framework PC? Because that was kind of an interesting announcement.
No. Is that the Linus Tech
They
Tip
were the
guy?
ones that had the laptop, and now they're coming up with a desktop. Yeah, I just wanted to say really quickly, I was annoyed that they couldn't get the new AMD chip to fit on a laptop, so they decided to make a desktop. I think that was the backstory of it. But meanwhile, Asus did put it on a laptop, and everybody loves it. So it's kind of like, I wonder if Framework is going to go back and redesign some of their stuff, because it seems like their platform can't accept everything. And I think maybe it was the wattage limits is what they hit. But
You
I'm not
use a
certain on any
Framework
of that.
laptop, right?
Oh, sorry.
You have a that's your, like your personal laptop is a
Oh
Framework.
yeah, the Framework 13. I love it, and it can still get the 370 chip from AMD. That one's you will have to wait because you have to wait for them to have spare main boards. Once they do, I'll absolutely upgrade to that. It's been a wonderful machine to me, but it won't go up to the 395, which is what the desktop does. And again, I think they cited voltage, I think the concern. And it just kind of makes sense. I mean, a USB-C that takes 130 watts, but pretty big wattage draw on the new AMD chip.
Is the case plastic or metal?
Metal.
And
Yeah.
you have one? That's cool. That sounds
Oh yeah.
interesting.
And it's fun because when you replace the main board in it, it's still a full computer, and they have, I think, some open 3D print. Yeah, they just in the picture above, I think one above. Yeah, I think there. So you can actually repackage your old main board into a keyboard format, and you can still have that as a working computer if you want.
Given their flexibility and customizability, I was always hoping that one of them days they will get one of those ThinkPad little red nubbin buttons on their keyboard. That'll be the day.
Don't count it out yet. I mean, the 16 would be probably the one to do it, right? They already have modular, and the keyboard face itself is already changeable. So, and that's open source, I believe, hardware. So you just need to go find your favorite hardware vendor and be like, "Hey, why don't you make one of these?"
Oh, the dream, the dream.
Right?
Until you use it enough that you actually wear off the thing. I remember all my ThinkPads would look like a highly used like pencil eraser after like, 6 months because I was like constantly on that nubbin thing.
But hey, in this case, you just replace that part of the keyboard. You don't have
Yeah.
to buy a new computer.
I'm gonna go back to my compact portable 3. That's the that was my favorite computer ever.
Pretty cool. Yeah, you've talked about your framework laptop before. I never checked out the site. They do look a lot more interesting now.
Oh yeah. And the AMD hardware is pretty good. I have no complaints about the speed of it, and I run Nixos on it. Yeah, it does have so for Michael, it does have the fingerprint reader, and it does work in Linux. Feels good to be able to just use your fingerprint for sudo.
How does the cost of that compare to like a MacBook?
Oh, that's hard to say. I mean, I think the initial cost is more, but then the subsequent upgrades for at least the 13 have been really cheap because you don't buy the full laptop anymore. You just buy the chip, and you can keep the memory sometimes, and the don't have to buy a new hard drive or frame or anything else.
How long has Framework been around now?
I'd say 5 years. I think that's what they were celebrating, I think in their blog. That's why they came up with the news. So they have a 12 inch now, which is a touch screen. Everybody's hoping that they also add touch screens to the rest of the laptop lineup, though. Yeah, this and the desktop are a part of their 5 year celebration of, hey, we're not dead. Because it's what they're doing is really hard. I can't say that
Yeah.
everybody should just go out and buy one because obviously it's still a risk.
It's a very niche demographic that they're targeting of power users. Cool. Any other questions? Any other interesting announcements?
For what it's worth, I just went and tried to like price one against like my MacBook, and it's actually significantly less expensive than my MacBook. Doesn't quite have the same They don't have an option to have as many cores. I guess that might be why it's also cheaper.
For the 13 or the 16?
The 16.
Gotcha. Yeah, I'm not sure myself what they're planning if the 16 will ever have, because it has the back side is replaceable for hardware. I wonder if they're ever going to expand out into that for bigger CPU.
I had a quick question following up from a message I posted in the Cloud Posse Slack. I was curious to know if anyone had experience working with RDS global data sets. I'm doing some client-facing work for that and was just curious to poll on anyone's experience in the short couple of minutes that we have.
Unfortunately, not recent. When we did our RDS global work originally, we were really excited about it, but it proved to be premature or immature to start using it. Now I think they've finally addressed some of those issues. For example, you couldn't do any major version upgrades of Postgres in the earlier versions of global RDS. I think they've since fixed that now, and there's some way of doing it. But yeah, no, we're not doing it anywhere ourselves right now, even though I think we have a module for it somewhere.
Yeah, I remember. So I looked through kind of the Cloud Posse RDS stuff, and there was some reference to like global. But I think the resources changed or there were some configuration differences. So I'm kind of essentially jumping off the well-trodden path and figuring out, hey, what it would look like to set this up. So.
Yeah. What is the didn't they offer don't they now offer some new global database with caveats or with limitations that might be easier to manage claiming Postgres compatibility?
And you're not talking about the Aurora specific version of it, are you?
I guess this is DSQL is what I'm thinking of. This was announced at reInvent and it's still in preview.
Okay.
But I think, if its limitations are acceptable, it sounds like a much easier solution to deploy and manage.
Yeah, exactly. I think that that's the big, if its limitations are acceptable, like because it doesn't have atomic writes, it doesn't have foreign key support as an example. So there's some big ones there that are missing.
Yeah.
Yeah, foreign keys.
Yeah, the fact that it's serverless makes me also wonder about if you're putting actual like load against it, like are you gonna pay, five times as much as you would for just kind of a standard setup.
Yeah. We learned that the hard way with serverless Redshift when we got a $15,000 bill, even though we were away on Christmas break and hadn't done anything.
Well, thanks for kind of sharing your experience with it. Whatever I find out, I'll definitely share back.
Oh, I never saw that one before. That's an interesting one on the bottom. A transaction can't modify more than 10,000 rows. So when you add to your schema and you need to in your migration you want to like seed the new column that you add or whatever, that seems like a huge limitation. You have to somehow run that like multiple times. Interesting.
Yeah, or loop it or something.
Yeah, I don't, like, but how do you even like normally you'd be like set default da 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 da, right? And
Yeah.
it will actually go and populate that in there. It seems like that wouldn't work. Oh, and a transaction can only include one DDL statement at a time. That's interesting.
Well, we are at time for today. Thanks everyone for your questions. We'll be posting a recording of this session to our YouTube channel. So if you have not yet, and this is that part where Google always disconnects. Google Sheets, yep, there we go. Yep, if you haven't subscribed yet, go there, click that button, like and subscribe. And then if you're curious about working with Cloud Posse at some point, book a meeting with me directly, and we'll show you how to do Terraform at scale. Go to cloudposse.com/meet. We also have a few action items here. If you haven't joined our community yet, you can go to slack.cloudposse.com, register for our weekly office hours, which is what you're listening to right now, or attending. And we also do syndicate this office hours session as a podcast, so you can listen to them in the car or train or however you listen to podcasts. So thanks, everyone. Talk to you next week.